Okay, one sec, let me just check some. Okay, hello everybody. I'm back this week. I was away last week at the Mises U in Auburn. It was a very nice program. I'm sorry for those of you who didn't attend it. I'm sorry you couldn't be there. It was a lot of fun. But now today, I just want to go over first a theme that we've of the course so far. Remember, we started by the third, the first two lectures on Plato and Aristotle, then when we got to Hobbes in the third lecture, there was a big change from what Plato and Aristotle was doing, in that Plato and Aristotle really take the state, especially of course the city state, as something that really exists by nature. People don't have to agree to form a government. It's just a natural institution that really, we can debate this, how much is true for Aristotle than for Plato, but the individual is really subordinate to the city state. So individuals couldn't really say, well, I didn't agree to the city state, so it doesn't have any force on me. And, I think Plato and Aristotle were aware of theories that found the state on consent, but they rejected them. Now, when we get to Hobbes, of course, we don't think of Hobbes at all as a defender of classical liberalism. He wasn't. Remember, the sovereign in Hobbes's Leviathan really has pretty much the power to do anything he wants. I mean, he's supposed to observe certain limits, but he can really do what he wants. But still, how is, according to Hobbes, how is the sovereign set up? Well, by people promising each other to obey the sovereign. So really we start from individuals and then they're giving up, they're agreeing to surrender to the sovereign their power to do what they want, because they value their security. Now then, in the next lecture on Locke, we saw the notion of consent going in a much more libertarian direction, that according to Locke, people have certain natural rights, people are self-owners, they have a right to acquire property, and then they form a government by consent. So then, here we have a government is founded on consent. First, everybody gets together, the whole community, and then the community then decides what to do by how the government is to be established by the majority decision. Now Rousseau, we were talking about last week, we go back in a somewhat more authoritarian direction in that you're all surrendering to general will, but here again we still have the notion of consent in that people are supposed to be surrendering everything to the general will in order, this kind of quixotic project, in order that even though they've surrendered, they can be as free as before. So now what we have in the lecture today, we're going to see how the notion of consent really, if you consider it in its full logical implications, it really has libertarian implications, and it really goes against having a government or state altogether. And we'll see this, we'll be discussing two great libertarians, one who lived in the 19th century, Lysander Spooner, and one who just died relatively recently, Murray Rothbard, lived from 1926 to 1995. I knew Murray Rothbard very well, but I didn't know Spooner. I'm old, but not that old. I first want to talk about Spooner, who should incidentally not, Lysander Spooner, should not be confused with the famous Warden Spooner of New College, Oxford, the one who had the famous Spoonerisms, where you get language mixed up. If you remember the one that Spooner once gave a sermon, and he ended the sermon, he said that wherever in the foregoing I said Aristotle, I meant St. Paul. So that was a different Spooner. But Spooner we're concerned with lived from 1808 to 1887. And one of the probably his most important, best known in history, other than his work as a writing political theory, he was an abolitionist. He was very strongly opposed to slavery, and he was part of a group, actually, I think called the Secret Six, that was trying to finance John Brown, the famous opponent of slavery who tried to incite a slave rebellion and was hanged shortly before the Civil War began. So Spooner was one of those who financed it. And he argued, in an interesting way, that the U.S. Constitution really didn't support slavery, didn't authorize slavery. Now, this is kind of an odd thing to say, because you could say, well, look, doesn't the Constitution really does authorize slavery, because it said fugitive slaves have to be returned to their masters. It says in the three-fifths clause, you're counting other persons, referring to slaves as five other persons count for three persons. And then there's a clause about the slave trade can't be prohibited before 1808. So how is Spooner going to say that the U.S. Constitution doesn't really authorize slavery? Well, he put up a pretty good case for it, even though it seems very something you wouldn't expect. And I'll just say a little bit about how he argued for that. Well, he said first, suppose somebody said, look, you couldn't possibly be right because the Southern slave owners, the people with the Constitutional Convention, would never have supported the Constitution unless it allowed slavery. So how could you possibly say it doesn't? What he said, and this is, I think, a very interesting interpretative move, the reason I'm going on a little bit about this, I think it's an interesting question in how we read texts. He said, what's important in reading a text is not the subjective intentions of the people who wrote it, but what the text actually said. So he said, well, it very well might be that the Southern slave owners didn't really intend to, they intended to authorize slavery. In fact, they didn't in what they wrote. And why did Spooner think that the Constitution, if you read it properly, didn't authorize slavery? Well, he appealed to a principle that Chief Justice Marshall stated he agreed with, which was if the Constitution, the people have certain natural rights, and if the Constitution can be interpreted in such a way that it's in accord with these rights, then it should be taken that way. Only if you have absolute clarity that the Constitution is going against people's rights should you take it as saying that. Also, since he thought that slavery violated human rights, then he would say only if you have absolute clarity that the Constitution favors slavery should you take it that way. And he had very ingenious ways of getting around these passages that seem to authorize slavery. For example, he said, well, the so-called, he said, slavery is never actually referred to by name, in the Constitution, by that word in the Constitution, we say when it talks about, the fugitive slave clause, all it says is persons bound to service. So he said, well, that could just refer to indentured servants, not to slaves. Or, and he said, the slave trade just is importation of persons. So he said that wasn't referring to slaves either. So he had very ingenious ways of getting around what you, sort of the obvious meaning of the text, because he said when you're interpreting the document, if you can possibly interpret it in a way that's in accord with people's natural rights, then you should. But he came, even though he's saying here the Constitution didn't support slavery, he came, especially in his later work, like the one called the Constitution, No Treason, the Constitution, No Authority, number 6, there were a whole series of short essays or short pamphlets under that title, where he tended to think now the Constitution should be rejected altogether. And here is what I think is his principal contribution to political theory, that he really demolished consent theories of political obligation. Remember what we find in the thinkers, beginning with Hobbes, and especially in Locke, who's the most libertarian of the thinkers other than the ones we're talking about today. Locke was saying, well, look, people have natural rights. They have a right to their self-owners. They can own property. But the way they establish a government, since they have these natural rights, is they agree among each other to surrender to the government their right to enforce the law of nature. So government isn't something arbitrary, but it rests on consent. So what Spooner said is, well, if you take this requirement of consent seriously, you'll see it's almost impossible to meet it. So you really can't, so we say it's correct that if there's a legitimate government, it has to rest on consent. But in fact, those requirements really can't be met, so you're not going to be able to have a legitimate government. So what he did, he was a very literal-minded person. I don't know this, but I think it's very unlikely he is someone who would tell jokes or make ironic remarks. He would take what he read absolutely literally. And he asked some very basic questions. Some apply just to the U.S. Constitution, but others, most significant for political theory, would apply to any type of claim that the government rests on consent. He said, well, if you say the Constitution rests on consent, who actually consented to it? Who are these people who were supposed to have consented to it? Somebody said, well, it was ratified by conventions in the different states, but he wants a list. He said, well, if you're talking about consent, you have to have a list of the actual people who said, I consent to the Constitution. So we don't have such a list. We have people, that we have delegates in these state conventions who voted in favor of the Constitution. We don't have any list of individuals who say, I consented to the Constitution. But suppose you could come up with a list. They had some very long list. Say we had people in the U.S. that you had a long list of people who said, I consent to the Constitution. Then why would such a list bind anybody else, supposing other people didn't say, I accept the Constitution? There were a lot of people who opposed it. Why would the Constitution bind them? And what about any of us in the U.S. who came after those people? Why would we be bound by the Constitution just because there were some people at the time who accepted it? Let's assume everybody, which is false, that everybody at the time of the Constitution did consent to the Constitution. Why should that matter to us now? I mean, supposing somebody said that you owe me some money, and you said that why I didn't agree to that, and then the person said, oh, but somebody else agreed that you owed me this money. Why should you care about that? Now, Spooner, again, was very good at raising a whole lot of different objections. Sounds like, so far, he's got a very good case already against the validity of the Constitution, binding force the Constitution. He said, well, you know, who are these, where is the list of people who said they accept the Constitution? And even if you could come up with such a list, why should anybody else care about it? Why does it bind people who didn't consent or any of us now? So he said, well, supposing, though, you just consider the people who did consent, why should we assume perpetual consent? Why couldn't it be something like, well, they just said, all right, let's see how the Constitution works for a while, but then maybe why can't they change their mind? Maybe they said that we don't like the Constitution anymore. And in fact, if you look at the Spooner's position in the Civil War, even though he was a very strong opponent of slavery, he thought the Southern states did have the right to secede, because he thought, you know, if people, even if they had consented to be in the form of government, they had the right to change their mind. Of course, he didn't think the Southern people had consented. He said, even if they did, why should you assume that their consent is perpetual? It's a bit like the other view. It's a bit like there's some mental hospitals where you can check in, but you can't check out. So Spooner said, no, even if you did consent, why assume that this consent is perpetual? Now, also, what he's doing is making it more and more difficult to accept the notion of consent, except that the consent could be satisfied. He says, well, if you say that government is our representative or agent, so say I'm consenting to the government, I'm saying this group of people is my agent, it isn't enough, say, if I just acknowledge this, say, by voting in private for the government. I have to state this publicly. So he said, well, for to have true consent, it wouldn't only have to be the case that you accepted the government, you'd have to state this publicly. So what he's really doing in this series of arguments is he's saying, well, you say the government has to be founded on consent, and that seems right. It's unjust to just impose a government on people, even against their will. But consent really has to be taken literally. And to have a legitimate government over certain people, they all have to agree to it. So true consent has to be unanimous. Suppose I don't like the U.S. government. So then as long as I'm here, then the government really doesn't rest on unanimous consent, so it's really illegitimate, because it couldn't claim any right to rule over me unless I'd accepted this. Now, although Spooner is really mainly studied by libertarians, I mean, he's regarded by historians as a person of interest to people who are specialists in 19th century history, you won't find him studied much in mainstream courses in political philosophy. But there was a very influential short book by the philosopher Robert Paul Wolff, who taught at Columbia University and then at the University of Massachusetts for many years. He's retired. He has actually still has a blog called The Philosopher's Stone. And he wrote a very good book called In Defense of Anarchism, and he gives very similar arguments to Spooner. He said, well, if government is supposed to be legitimate, then it really has to be unanimous, direct rule. So it's, I think, interesting that Spooner's argument, I don't think Wolf had read Spooner before he wrote his book, although I think his students called his attention to a parallel with Spooner, but he gave a very similar argument that attracted some attention. Now, there's one objection we could think of to Spooner, is that one thing he does in raising problems with the notion of consent to political authority is he takes certain requirements from law of contracts, which is for contract law, which has a very well established rules in common law on how you form a binding contract. So he says, well, here are the requirements for a binding contract. They're not observed in political claims where people have consented to political obligation. We don't have these terms. So there is no proper consent, but you could imagine someone who objected, well, why, even if you're right that these political consent takes place in a different way than the way customary in contract law, why is that such a good objection? Why should political consent just have different requirements from those of contract law? So even if you can show that the requirements of contract law are met, so what? So I think Spooner could answer that objection, isn't one as far as I know to be explicitly considered. I think, well, we get from contract law an unproblematic notion of consent. So if you want to say there's some other kind of consent, then the burden is on you to show what it is. And he thought that the people who favored political consent theories hadn't met that burden. Now, one argument sometimes people who favor government make is, well, people pay taxes to the government. So they would say, well, just in the way, say, you go down to the store and buy something, or let's say you paid money to listen to my course, doesn't that show you consented to listen to my lecture? Of course, it's up to you whether you listen or not, but if you claimed to someone, the people at the Mises Institute have made unauthorized, they've taken money in an unauthorized way from your credit card, it would be a good answer. No, you consented to this because you clicked on the button to enroll in the course and gave your credit card information. So you're doing this voluntarily. So the argument would be, well, people are paying taxes, so doesn't that show that they really do consent? But of course, there's a very obvious problem with that Spooner pointed out. He said, taxation is compulsory, so you can't say paying taxes indicates consent, because if you don't pay, the government's going to come after you. And Spooner says here, I think it's a very well-expressed point, he says, the government is worse than a highwayman. You know, at that time, there were people who would be traveling by horse or stagecoach. There would just be people who would come up to them on the road and rob them, called highwaymen. So he says, well, with a highwayman, that the person is robbing you, but he doesn't pretend that he's doing it for your own good. But Spooner says the government is worse than that, because the government is robbing you. They're taking money from you without your consent, but they're claiming this is really for the common good. So this is addition to being robbery, it's hypocritical. Now, you might say, well, isn't there a better case for consent by voting? Because there can be countries, I think Australia is one, where voting is compulsory, but usually voting is voluntary. A lot of people in the U.S. don't vote in elections. So couldn't you say if people voted in an election for the government, say we have a presidential election coming up soon, so if you voted, doesn't that show you're authorizing the government because you're voting for somebody? So Spooner said, no, that's not right, because it might be that people didn't consent to the system. It's just that given that we have the system, people are voting because they're trying to make the best of a bad situation. So it could be people would prefer, and some people would prefer not having the government or not having the kind of government we have, but given that we do have a government, they could just be picking, they could just think one candidate or group of candidates would be better than another. So you can't, according to Spooner, say from the fact that people voting this indicates consent. So as you see, Spooner has some specific arguments that apply to the U.S. Constitution, said, well, what happened when the Constitution was ratified? But many of the arguments are more general. You could say for any government, which are the people who actually consented to it? So I think Spooner's really made a very important contribution to political theory, because he's shown that if you take consent to government seriously, it's almost impossible to satisfy the requirements of consent. You're going to get a good argument then that all government is illegitimate. So the basic foundation to Spooner's approach, the whole approach to government, he thinks that people have a natural right to govern themselves. We have natural rights. And so unless people actually consent, again, it's going to be the argument that I'll explain, that these requirements for actual consent is extraordinarily difficult to satisfy, people can't give up this right to someone else or some group. So he said, well, you could come up with a scenario in which everybody agreed to have the government, but it would be almost impossible to realize that. So what we have is that people have a natural right to govern themselves, and government is illegitimate. Now, sometimes, and this is one thing Locke said, is that we should give up some of our rights, like the right to enforce the law of nature, because if we do that, the government is going to protect the rest of our rights. Remember, Locke's basic argument is, in the state of nature, enforcing the law of nature by individuals leads to all sorts of problems. So we're all better off if we surrender to the government our right to enforce the law of nature. We're still keeping our other rights, but we're surrendering to government right to enforce the law of nature. So Spooner said, no, this won't work, because then the government's going to be able to set the limits of its own powers, and if it does that, of course, it's going to say that keep increasing its own power, people will have less and less rights, less and less freedom. We've seen this happen, certainly in the way the U.S. government has developed over the course of history. Now, well, supposing you accept Spooner and you say, well, consent really can't be met, so what are people going to do? Don't we need laws, some sort of laws to regulate people's behavior? So Spooner said no, because natural law settles all important matters like personal rights, existence, nature, problems. It is all a matter of settled by natural law. And if you said, well, even say we know by natural law people have a right to acquire property, don't we have to have certain regulations saying, well, what exactly do you need, say, to homestead property? How do you settle boundary disputes? Don't need legislation there. So Spooner was inclined to deny that. He thought that practically all questions could be settled by natural law, so there's no scope, really proper scope for government to operate. Now, when we talk about natural law, this brings us right to Murray Rothbard, because Rothbard, especially in Ethics of Liberty, which is his main book on political philosophy, bases his whole libertarian system on a version of natural law ethics. So what Rothbard claims, and here he differed from his great teacher, Ludwig von Mises. Remember, Rothbard wasn't formally enrolled as a student in Mises' class, but he was he regularly attended Mises' famous seminar at New York University beginning in 1949. So Mises thought that really, remember Mises says that in economics we have preferences that are subjective. People just have prefer certain things to others, and preferences are just according to whatever the individual chooses. And Mises thought that ethics didn't change that. People, there's no such thing as an objective preference of what we ought to prefer. Just people have certain preferences. But nevertheless, Mises thought you could get an ethical system on that foundation, but he said, even though there's no such thing as objectively correct preferences, in fact, everyone, or nearly everyone, wanted peace and prosperity. So you could say, well, everyone, in fact, wants peace and prosperity. And then you could say, how do you achieve that? Namely, by establishing the free market system, social cooperation through the free market. So Mises had, I think, a very ingenious approach. He said, even though we don't have to say that there's such thing as objectively true ethics, but we can still come up with an ethical system because everybody, in fact, does one, has certain preferences. But Rothbard doesn't agree to that. He said, no, ethical judgments are true and false, and we can say, if you have certain preferences, then your preferences could be mistaken. You're preferring wrong things. So how does he show that? How does he try to show there's such a thing as objective ethics? Well, it mainly is done so by appealing to natural law, especially as developed by St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, this raises the problem, which is that Aquinas was a Catholic theologian, maybe the greatest, or one of the greatest, along with St. Augustine, one of the greatest of all Catholic theologians. And Aquinas thought that natural law was part of divine law. So the question comes up, if you accept natural law, does that commit you to accepting the claims of a particular religion, of course, in Aquinas' case, that of the Roman Catholic Church, or if it doesn't commit you to accepting particular religions, you at least have to accept certain philosophical claims about God. So Aquinas, the problem then, Aquinas said natural law is part of divine law, so does it follow if you accept natural law, then that this commits you to certain claims about existence of God that appears to be quite controversial. So Rothbard says in response to that, and I think Rothbard himself wasn't a believer in God, So he says, even though Aquinas thought that natural law was part of God's law, finding out what the requirements of natural law depended only on human reason. So it wasn't saying that because we accept natural law, we don't have to accept the Bible or biblical revelation, we don't have to accept the particular teachings, say, of the Catholic Church or some other religious group. We just try to figure out by reason the requirements of natural law. So even if Aquinas turned out to be right that natural law is part of divine law, accepting natural law wouldn't commit us to accepting divine law. That would just be a particular, that would just be part of Aquinas' system. But you could detach the natural law part from the rest of Aquinas' views and say this is freestanding. And just in the same way, you can actually do that with Locke, where Locke has certain theological beliefs that you could detach and account of how property required, what rights people have from this particular theological beliefs, at least it's been argued that you can. And here, Rothbard was in accord with Aquinas himself, because Aquinas didn't thought that natural law could just be discovered entirely by reason. It wasn't dependent, even though Aquinas thought natural law is part of divine law, you don't have to accept divine law in order to realize natural law is correct. It would just be, if Aquinas is right, you didn't think that natural law was part of divine law, then you would just fail to have to know something about natural law, even though it's part of divine law, but that wouldn't affect the validity of natural law. And here, this view that natural law is detachable from divine law is one that came in very much with the great Dutch legal theorist Hugo Grotius. You also find it in some later scholastic like Suarez, where Grotius said, this is the famous quotation, Grotius, he said, what we've been saying would have a degree of validity even if we should conceive that which cannot be conceived without the utmost wickedness, that there is no God or the affairs of men or no concerns. So what Grotius is saying, this is in accord with Rothbard's view, is that you can accept natural law can be taken really as freestanding. It isn't dependent on particular theological beliefs. And in fact, now there's one type of ethical system that very much is dependent on accepting belief in God, which is called divine command ethics, which is to say something is good or right just in case God has commanded it. So that wouldn't really go, suppose you didn't believe in God, it would be very odd to accept divine command ethics. I mean, I think what someone once said as a joke, they wanted to accept divine command ethics and also the view that God hasn't spoken yet, so we can really get an argument for ethical nihilism, because divine command ethics is the correct view, but God hasn't spoken. So Rothbard draws an interesting parallel between this view of divine command ethics, which is not natural law, it's just the view that ethics depends on just what God has said is good, and legal positivism, which is the view that laws are just what the legislator commands. So Rothbard said, well, this divine command ethics is like legal positivism because they both, at least for the certain versions of divine command ethics, the more sophisticated versions of that view would avoid this objection. In both this crude divine command, ethics rule, and legal positivism. I should say, law has no basis in reason. The ethics have no basis in reason. So ethical rules are just commands of God. And the legal positivism says laws are just commands of God. So this is a view that Rothbard is opposing. So, again, Rothbard says, well, there's a natural law that's established by reason. So what we're concerned with, what he didn't claim to work out in full, what the requirements of natural law were, but he was just concerned with a particular branch of natural law, which is political philosophy, and this is concerned only with part of ethics. So what you're concerned with in political philosophy, according to Rothbard, is the permissible use of force. When can one person use force on somebody else? So ethical issues that don't involve force are not covered. Say there are issues on the, is it all right to lie to people in your personal relations with them? And you can certainly hold that it's objectively wrong to do that, but that wouldn't be covered in political philosophy. What we've been doing in political philosophy is just establishing people's rights, which in a right would be a claim that people could use force to secure. Say if you have a property right to your house, that implies that if someone takes your house without your consent, it would be legitimate for you to use force to expel them. So what political philosophy is concerned with, according to Rothbard, is permissible use of force. Now the separation between political philosophy and other parts of ethics, you don't really get this in the ancient world. It really comes from Locke, where Locke was, I think, the first one to really have this very strong separation. And the 19th century German philosopher, Fichte, who's one of the great idealists, he's usually thought of as an authoritarian. He was in a lot of his later writing, but he started off as someone with a very libertarian view. And he said, well, political philosophy isn't trying to establish the whole of ethics, but just this particular part of ethics is concerned with political use of force. When I see an official name, I'll just tell you a kind of funny story that happened at the Mises University last week. Roderick Long gave a very good lecture that was dealing with covering what Mises had said about a priori truth as part of the lecture. And a student asked him whether he thought that Mises was more influenced by Kant or by Fritsch. And neither Roderick nor I had any idea who Fritsch was. I think it was just that someone had gotten confused about someone's philosophy, but she thought there was a philosopher named Fritsch. And she wondered how much Mises had been influenced by him. I must have it reminded me of the story of the professor who lectured his class on Hegel, Schlegel, and Bagel, and then he told them to forget what he said about Bagel because there was no such person. That you can laugh now if you're so inclined. Now, that is, okay, Rothbard is trying to get what the, talk about political philosophy, he wants to talk about what is the permissible use of force, so how do we find out what are the rights people have that are relevant to political philosophy, because that's how we figure out what is the permissible use of force. You need to know what rights people have. So he asked, as you would expect from someone in the natural law tradition, what do people need in order to flourish? Flourishing means being a good life, being happy. So he said, each person needs to be a self-owner. What does that mean? That each person has the right to decide what to do with his or her own body. Supposing, let's say, somebody really needs a kidney, but needs to have a kidney transplant, and it happens that you're an extremely good match for this person, but suppose you don't like the person very much and just don't feel like giving your kidney to it, then it's still up to you whether you do it or not. It would be wrong to say, well, this person needs the kidney more than you do because you can't live unless you get the new kidney, and although it would impose some difficulties on you, you can live with one kidney and not two, so we're going to force you to have a kidney transplant. This would seem like it would be a gross violation of justice because it's your body. So what the self-ownership claim is that each person has the right to decide what to do with his or her own body. Remember, we talk about rights in the author's conception of political philosophy. We mean, when is it permissible, we talk about situations when it's permissible to use force. So you have the right to, by force, to prevent other people from doing things with your body that you don't want. If people try to force you to have a kidney transplant, it would be wrong to do that, and you would be right to resist them. Now, a lot of people, including some libertarians, don't like the notion of self-ownership, or even if they don't have any feelings about it, they think it's philosophically problematic. They say, well, maybe the basic idea is all right, but you shouldn't really talk about self-ownership. They raise various problems with it. But it isn't a really difficult notion. All that it means is that each person should be in control of decisions about his or her own body, such as, for example, a kidney transplant or with others, like blood donation. It's up to you what you do with your own body. Of course, you couldn't say, well, I can punch you because it's my fist and I have the right to do what I want with my fist, including for you. It's just you have the right to do what you want with your own body as long as you don't violate other people's rights. So if you don't, then what you do with your body is up to you. So some people, well, why do people object to the concept of self-ownership? Well, they say, if you're talking about self-ownership, doesn't this, what does that sound like? I've been bombed, it was probably just a delivery, I hope. So self-ownership does not imply that the mind, some people think it means that the mind would really be owning the body. So we say, talk about self-ownership, this means the mind owns the body, and then people say, well, that rests on certain views about the relation of the mind and the body, like the mind exists separately from the body and owns it, just like something that could exist independently of the mind. But this isn't right. Self-ownership isn't saying, well, there's a separate mind that owns the body. It doesn't make any assumptions about the mind-body relation at all. It's just saying, as I mentioned before, that each person should be in control of his basic decisions about his or her own body. So what do we mean when we talk about self-ownership? Well, it's really a reflexive term. What I mean by that, suppose we say someone lacks self-esteem. Someone is just a very timid person, say he lacks self-esteem. What would that mean? Well, it wouldn't mean that the person's self, or some separate part of the person, called the self, that lacks its being for something else, for example, the person's body. Or say somebody lacks self-esteem, it doesn't mean the person's mind doesn't think very highly of his body. And sometimes people do have a, think they look ugly or things wrong with their body, but this isn't what we mean when we say somebody lacks self-esteem. We just mean that the person doesn't regard himself very highly. We're not making any kind of separation between the person or the person's mind and their body. So in the same way, we're saying the self-owner would be controlling certain aspects of himself, not something else that isn't, again, I'm going over this in a number of times because people very frequently miss this. When you're saying self-owner, you're not suggesting that the mind is separate from the body. Of course, you're not, it's not rejecting that view either. It's just not taking any position on mind-body relations. Just, I say, reflexive terms. We have all sorts of words out of somebody. Self-esteem, self-regard, so on. Again, it's self-ownership is a term like that. Now, how do we, does Rothbard try to show that people are self-owners? Well, what he does is he says, well, what are the possible systems we could have? Well, we could have, if you don't have self-ownership, you could have a system where some people own others through slavery and enslaved society, the masters own the slaves, so the slaves aren't self-owners. And we could imagine a system in things political democracies like it, where we each have shares of everybody else. So each person has a part share of everybody else. And he objects to that system where he says each person has the part share of everybody else. And he said, well, that couldn't work because if we each own parts of ourselves, then we'd all have to agree on to do anything because, say, suppose I say I want to move my arm here. Well, I couldn't do that unless I just own a small part, sort of a share of my arm, so I'd have to get the agreement of all the other shareholders in my arm to move my arm, and that would be cumbersome and impossible to do. So he really rejects that view. Now, what about slavery? So he says, well, isn't it really obvious that slavery is wrong? Don't we just know that it is? So here, I think this is an important point about Rothbard's thought that I think he's often missed or some people even miss, because I think a lot of people don't like this way of doing moral philosophy, but Rothbard is at least in part a moral intuitionist. Now, what do I mean by that? An intuitionist is not someone who goes by feeling or hunches, but an intuitionist says we have direct knowledge of the truth of certain moral claims. For example, suppose I say it's wrong to kill babies for fun. Well, how do I know that? It isn't that I deduced it from some moral theory. It's just I can grasp it right away. It's just obvious that that's true. So suppose somebody said, well, how do you know that? Why is it true? The person would be really missing the point because this is just something that is directly grasped as true. So I think what Rothbard was doing really was saying, at least for some moral truths, we have a direct grasp that they're true. So we can just grasp right away that slavery is wrong. So then, supposing then your group. So Bob says, interesting if we eliminate for fun. Well, I think we could still say it's wrong to kill babies. I just put that in for fun, sort of to make it something no one could possibly deny. But, I mean, I accept your amended principle, it's wrong to kill babies, is also one that would directly know to be true. So, given self-ownership, so we say that Rothbard is right in what he says about self-ownership, then he says, well, remember, he's rejected slavery as something that's obviously wrong, and the system will reach on shares of everybody else just wouldn't work, so he thinks self-ownership is the only thing left standing. Then he says, well, how do we acquire property? And he says, well, land and other resources start out unowned, and people own their own labor. And when they mix their labor with the unowned land in an appropriate way, they acquire the land. So you start off here with the unowned land, and I own my labor, and I do something to the land to acquire it, and I own it. Now, there's some people, I think Stefan Kinsella is one, who has various objections to owning labor, but I don't see what's wrong with saying that people own their own labor. But some people do object to that. It seems perfectly all right to me. So what happens? How does this all tie in with the main theme of the lecture day, which is the basis of political obligation? Well, according to Rothbard, once we have people who are self-owners and they acquire property by a labor mixture, and then once they've acquired the property, then they can give it to other people or trade with other people. There's no room for a legitimate state once you've settled the self-ownership of the property. There's no room for anything else, because Rothbard thought that all rights are property rights. So there's no room for a legitimate state. Of course, if you want people to say you want to protect yourself from attack by criminals, you're certainly free to hire an agency to protect you, but that isn't a government, because that's just a regular relationship you have just like with any other business. So once you have self-ownership in property, then you really don't have room for anything else. So there's no basis for a government in Rothbard's system. So we have really, I think, Spooner and Rothbard will go well together, because Spooner's really demolished the consent theory of political obligation, and Rothbard has a natural law argument that people's rights don't leave any scope for government. So, okay, so I think that'll be it. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to go to the Q&A box and open that, but you could still put things in the chat box if you want, but you can also type them in into the Q&A. Okay, let me see. Roger says, would you agree the term consent is used by politicians to fool the people into accepting their rule? Yes, I think that's a very good point you raise. I think in the U.S., people say, well, this is really our government, we consent to it, but we really didn't. Sometimes, I didn't mention the lecture, people will say, well, just by living in this country, we're tacitly consenting to the government. But as my friend Bob knows it, like to say, tacit consent isn't worth the paper it's not written on. So I think, Roger, you're perfectly right. Okay, while you're thinking of another question, I'll just be right back. I had a lot of Diet Coke this this afternoon. I'll be back in a minute. Okay, we're back now. Well, I see there's some good questions waiting for me. George says, if you don't mind, can we mention Edward Fayes in a past life, who's generally critical of Rothbard's idea of self-ownership of private property. Can you please explicate Fayes' argument and what its general weaknesses, those traditionalist-like arguments against Rothbard? Well, I wrote something on, I know Ed Fayes, and I wrote something on that, I think you can find it at the LRC. What Ed Fayes basically says is he objects to the notion of libertarian rights that you don't have a right to do what's wrong. Oh, wait, somebody turned off the mic here. Oh, I see. I'll get to that a little later. Okay, so what he said is, let's suppose, and he believes, engaging in an adulterous relationship is morally wrong. Because it's wrong of people to do that. So then you can't say people have a right to be free to do what they want in their sexual relations. It's wrong. You can't say, well, people shouldn't engage in adulterous behavior, but they have the right to do so because we don't have a right to be wrong. And the authority view would be, if you say people have a right, he's just saying that sphere of action, what you have a right to, is your choice, it's up to you to do, and your rights aren't contrary to just what you're morally obligated to do. It would be something like this, supposing we talk about voting, say, that's not usually one of the standard of chair rights, supposing you say, you have the right to vote for the candidate you want, so it would, if you said, well, you can only vote for the candidate who in fact is objectively the right one, that would be really saying you don't really have a right to vote. So I think, but what I think is problematic with Ed Fayes' view is that he's trying to say you only have a right to do what you're morally ought to do, so he's really not allowing sufficient role for your freedom to choose what you want to do. You see, it would sound odd to say, well, you have a right to do something that's morally bad, but you don't have the right under that description. It's just you have a right to do what you want in certain spheres, and that could include doing something that's morally bad. Now, Samuel says, how can moral truth be self-evident and not established by reason? Is that what Longfellow is saying? I don't think he holds that for all moral truths. He thinks a lot are established by reason. But, I mean, when you have an argument, you say, or argument for something by reason, it's going to depend on certain premises. And you say, well, how do you know those premises are true? And you might have further arguments for them, but you're going to get back eventually to premises that you simply accept without further grounds, otherwise you'd be going back and reading it. So what if you're doubtful about moral truth is self-evident? Well, I'd just say, let's consider the example I gave in the lecture, if it's wrong to kill babies for fun. Well, don't we just look at that and think about it and see if it's true, is it that we derived it from some moral theory? I think it's that no, in fact, if we came up with a theory that said that wasn't true, we know there's something wrong with the theory. Let's see, I have a certain question. There was something in the chat room also. There's one from there's one from Trent. What would you say the strongest argument against Rothbard and Spooner's view? Well, I think I find that Rothbard and Spooner's view convincing. I suppose what one type of argument, again, I think might be something like the self as we find it isn't the real self. I mean, we talked about that last week in the lecture on Rousseau, and say, well, what people, the real self is somehow it's just what people rationally ought to want, whether they do or not. So you can, by going according to these requirements, the real self, you can be justifying countering what people appear to want but don't really want. I find that not an acceptable view, but I think that might be, if you want the criticism of the Rothbardian view, that might be one way to go. But again, that wouldn't be the way I'd want to go. Now, glad you turned off the mic. I didn't. Now here's one I missed. Bob wants to know, so people didn't accept what their Spooner recommended was legitimate social political organization. Well, he doesn't really say, I think he just wants the government reduced as much as possible. He's just trying to get people to accept his views of consent. But he doesn't really say what he would want. He could get that he would try to limit the government as much as possible. Now, George says, what makes liberty or private property rights superior in Rothbard's view to other moral considerations? If there are objectively true moral values, for example, such as one commit suicide, why should we accept property rights overriding this? Well, see, it isn't that he's ranking all the moral truths and saying that private property rights rank above these. He's just saying, just asking the question, when is it permissible for people to use force? So somebody could hold, well, it really is a grave wrong for people to commit suicide, but unless other people have a right to stop that by force, it wouldn't follow that you could stop them from doing so. I missed part of your question. James Calvert says freedom is always to do something, therefore it must be subordinated to do something higher. Oh, well, you know, I reviewed James Calvert's book very favorably. I corresponded with him. I like him. I wouldn't agree with here from the fact, I think it's right, if you're free, you're free to do something, but it doesn't, this other part you say it has to be subordinated to something higher, that doesn't fall in the sense that the people are justified in coercively requiring you to act freely in order to do what objectively is higher. That would be something else. It might be, I think we can actually object on two grounds. Somebody could say, well, it's true that you want freedom in order to do something else, you might very well want treatment or do something else, but as I say, it doesn't follow from that that others have the right to force you to do, to subordinate your freedom to their conception of what you ought to be using freedom for. And then I think people could value freedom just in itself. They could say, well, you're free to do something, but you think you're having that freedom is of value in itself. Samuel says, I was strong in the sense of untruth, violate property rights. Mistruth does not violate property rights after reading, and yes, I'm confused with the Rothbard position. Well, it's not that any untruth violates property rights, but if, suppose I say, let's say, you bought from the Mises Academy lectures on history political thought, so then, let's say I gave lectures just on my favorite jokes on history professional wrestling, I would have taken your money really without your consent because you've given me money in exchange for my lectures on a particular subject, so I haven't given you what you paid for. So in that way, I've just in effect stolen your property. I'm taking your money, but you gave me the money on condition that I do something for you, and I didn't do it. So that would be where it's violating your property right, that I'm taking your money from you, but I'm not giving you the what you're exchanging it for. It would be something like, suppose you come into a shoe store, you buy a pair of shoes, and then the salesman just gives you a box, and open the box and it's empty, you haven't gotten what you paid for, so that's theft if you're using force. In effect, he's interfered with your property rights without your consent because you gave up your money in return for something you're not getting it. Okay, now here's one from George on Locke and Hobbes. Both have arguments against anarchy. Do you believe that anarcho-libertarians adequately address their arguments? And what are some of these libertarian arguments that claim anarchy won't fall into the specific trouble that Locke and Hobbes suggest? Well, when Locke and Hobbes spoke about anarchy, they meant really a system, sort of a state of affairs where enforcement of, especially in Locke, you can go over Hobbes, see if I can even get it from Locke, but really enforcement of people's rights is very uncertain. In Hobbes, people are a constant threat to each other, so I don't know, maybe you're going to kill me, so I can't really live in a stable relationship with you. But in the system of anarcho-libertarians have it, we do have a stable set of laws. Rothbard says everyone accepts the common law code. So the difference is that there isn't a monopoly agency enforcing these laws. So we have competing agencies, there's still a common law. Okay, so now Leslie said, what were Mises's reasons for rejecting natural law's basis of ethics? Well, and did he and Rothbard ever discuss their differences on ethics and anarchism? Mises' basic point, again, I mentioned this a little bit in the lecture, he thought that preferences are subjective. The notion of an objective ought just didn't make sense to him. He just said, well, we just have people's preferences, that's all there is to it. And he thought, in fact, that natural law systems, say, promulgated by the Catholic Church. It's been ways of interfering with the free market. He's very much against it. Now, Rothbard attended a session, I think it was a conference sponsored by the Volcker Fund, where he wrote up a report criticizing Mises' views on ethics. I don't know if he discussed his views with Mises in person. Now, Mises wrote a review of Man, Economy, and State for National Review, where it was very favorable to what he said, that he thought that Rothbard had made certain mistakes on ethical and legal questions. I don't know that he discussed those with Rothbard. I think they did have some discussions on anarchism, but Mises always rejecting anarchism. I know they did have some discussions on that. Now, Sanders says that the exchange is voluntary. Define doing it. Anyone's satisfaction is subjective. They say shoe and you think house. It's not their fault when they give you a shoe and say, oh, no, that would not be the way you take it in libertarianism. It isn't that when I'm exchanging a good with you, it isn't. So we're not trying to look, have this idea of, well, what's really important is what's going on in people's minds, and we have no access to this. And it's very much, we're talking about transactions that are actually out there in the world. I mean, it wouldn't make sense to say, maybe it would to say, well, even though what's coming out of my mouth are words about political obligation, I'm really talking about the 12th century English history, because that's what I'm really thinking about. So it doesn't matter what's coming out of my mouth. What's important is what I'm really thinking about, and that's just nobody can know that. That would be a very confused view of philosophy of mind. That's certainly not the view that Rothbard is giving them. It was a political theory. Oh, now, okay, let's see up in the chat and then from Charles says, there's something saying that baby killing has been accepted, and then you're saying the circumstance. How to be self-evident that killing babies is wrong, that the whole society is wrong, that seems they're acting in the intent to advance a group survival. Yes, I mean, there's some society, suppose we say it's objectively the case, which I think it is, that the earth revolves around the sun. There are some societies that didn't accept that, so they were wrong. I mean, why should we think that the purpose of what's involved in ethics is advancing the survival of one's group? That would be a kind of biological reductionism that would be wrong. When you say self-evident, it's just an appeal to each person, say, here's the way it is, isn't that right? And if you say it is, that isn't gainsaid by the fact that there are people or groups who deny them. Suppose we say killing babies for fun is wrong. It isn't the point against it to say, oh, well, here's some society over here in which they do kill babies for fun. I'm not sure why we should think that unless we're just presuming, and we have to go by according to our own judgment. And of course, if you yourself don't accept such a judgment, then obviously that the argument that appeals to such intuitions won't have any purchase with you. So just dependent really on how you take it. Okay. Again, let's get back to Samuel's very interesting question. The question isn't how are people subjectively satisfied, it's just what is the case in the exchange. I mean, supposing you bought some shoes and you get shoes, and if you paid for them, you couldn't just say, I mean, it would just depend on the terms of the exchange, but you might not be able to say, well, through those shoes, but I just don't happen to like shoes anymore, so if the exchange is invalid, no, I mean, that wouldn't be a case of fraud. It doesn't depend on their satisfaction. Of course, we could have cases where, say, a guy gives you an empty box and you like that, I mean, but that would be not the sort of thing we have in mind. I mean, you could accept it if you're so inclined, but it would still be fraud if you, because it's not, you know, it's decided you're not going to do anything about fraud, but that would be something else. Here's one here. I see reviews of any of David Kelly's works in Logic. Well, the only review I've done of David Kelly, I reviewed his book Evidence of the Senses in the International Philosophical Quarterly right after it came out. I had a very nice letter from him. Oh, and I reviewed another book by him that wasn't really on. Is more of a political, short political book, but I reviewed Evidence of the Senses. I haven't reviewed his Logic textbook, but I think he's a good philosopher, but I haven't reviewed that one, but I did review Evidence of the Senses. Bob said, please help me understand the last part, point of the last slide, no view for a legitimate state. Well, okay, suppose you have a state, and you say, we can give you orders like how you're going to use certain property, we can establish rules how you use certain property, you have to do certain things, you have to pay taxes to us. So in Rothbard's system, say you just have self-owners and then they acquire property. And for Rothbard, all rights are property rights. So once you've settled the property rights, which are ones that individuals have, then there's no room for a state to operate, because the state would be saying, you have to do certain things with such and such property, but the property is all owned by individuals. So you see, there's no room for it. There's no foothold a state can get into to start giving orders. Of course, people could set up and they could establish an agency which would protect their rights, but that would be strictly according to voluntary on their part. It wouldn't be a conventional state. Okay, Bob says, thank you. Well, you're very welcome. I don't have a good response for that question. Okay, George says, Dr. Gurney, I want to thank you so much for teaching me. It's been a pleasure and honor. Oh, I like you already. I hope taking another course that you consider teaching not related economy. This is an introductory course of general philosophy, second logic played course, which covers different material, the one centered on Joyce's great book. Well, those are excellent suggestions, you know, we'll certainly think about those. Trent likes my course. Oh, good. Well, we have some nice people in this course. I've been very fortunate to get such good students in my courses. I'm very grateful. Obama's third class meal. That's nice. Okay, we still have another 5 minutes. A lot can happen in 5 minutes. Now, I should say, I have one more quiz for you. Now, some of you have, I think some people asked about quiz number three. I think I forgot to send that in. I did send it in to Danny earlier this week, so that would be post-entry. Now, Bob says, would be better off as anarchists. Well, I guess that would just depend on the particular circumstances. I think we would have reason, I think we have good reason to think that a libertarian anarchist society would be work well, but I guess if we just have to find out and see what happens. You know, if it didn't, we'd be no worse off than we were before. As Sanders has written books on logic, would recommend Bought Conservative Science by Jerry McManus or any others. There's a book, there are a number of good ones. There's one short book by Peter Geach, G-A-C-H, on reasoning that I like. The title is escaping me, but just look for Peter Geach and Logic, not the collection Logic Matters. That's a very difficult book. But he has a short book on logic that's very good. I think very highly of that one. G-A-C-H, unusual name, is very good British philosophy. He was married to Elizabeth Anstey, who was also an outstanding philosopher. So, now there's another one. It's funny. Geach is one. Henry Veach, V-A-T-C-H. He had a book, I think, of this man, DeWitt Parker, that's very good. Now, George says, Patrick Hurley at the concise injection of logic. I'm not familiar with that one, but I'd certainly look at it. Sounds like, you know, based on your questions, I'd like you know what you're talking about. So probably that is a good one. Old Sam says your first music academy class. Oh, I'm glad you liked it. You know, if you can get by all my horrible jokes, then you show great fortitude of mind, in my opinion. Now, this was a class. We had a bit of a crisis in this class, but I won't say what that was, but you recall in one of the earlier lectures, there was one student who didn't care for certain remarks I made about a contemporary libertarian writer, but I won't go into that now. What course comes next? Well, I don't know that yet. I'm sure Danny Sanchez will let me know. So as you say, I'll have one more quiz for you. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I want to thank everybody. This is the end of the course, except for that one quiz. So thanks very much for coming to my class, and I hope we'll see you in future classes. You should also, there are all sorts of other Music Academy classes. You should be grateful. I think we have a very good program here, so please look into the other, some of the other courses. And thanks again, everybody. Bye, everybody. Okay.